From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll have the latest on a car crash at the auto auction in Billerica that's left at least 3 dead and 9 injured. Also, on Monday night, some Red Sox fans hurled racist taunts at the Orioles' Adam Jones. Last night, they gave him a standing ovation. But that doesn't erase Boston sports team's troubled history with race.
Berate us, cuss us out, tell us we suck, tell us, if we grounded out, ha-ha, whatever. Performance-based. Leave it to performance-based comments.
And Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse on how corporate cash has captured our democracy.
Along comes Citizens United in January of 2010, and from 2010 after, there has not been a single significant Republican-sponsored bill on carbon dioxide. Zero. The cardio flatlined.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. At least 3 people are dead and 9 injured after a car drove through a crowd of people today at the Linway Auto Auction in Billerica. According to state police, hundreds were gathered for the weekly auction when one of the cars in line to be seen suddenly accelerated at the indoor facility. It struck several people before crashing through a cinder block wall. Authorities say they believe the incident was an accident. Here's District Attorney Marion Ryan.
They'll be doing a reconstruction assessment in terms of the vehicle to rule out any incident issues with the vehicle, anything else that may have contributed to the accident.
WBUR reporter Fred Tice has been following the story, and he joins us now. Hi there, Fred.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, what more do we know about what happened today?
Well, so it was about 10:30 this morning, and there is a weekly auction here, big auction with hundreds of people. At this place called Linway Auction in Billerica, where car dealers come to sell, their trade-ins and to buy the trade-ins. And this is a big building. It's about a football field long. And there are these lanes where the cars drive down. And then there are other lanes where potential buyers are standing right next to there. There were hundreds of buyers, potential buyers in there, hundreds of workers inside. And all of a sudden, this Jeep Grand Cherokee that was being shown just took off and picked up people on as it was plowing through the crowd, threw other people off. At least 7 people were thrown off the car, according to one eyewitness I spoke to. And then it went through a wall. And we now have 3 people dead, 2 people who have life-threatening injuries, and a number of others who were severely injured.
It sounds like a terrible situation, Fred. Do we know anything more about the person who was behind the wheel of that Jeep?
Yeah, we do know that he was an employee, that he was in his 70s, and one of the buyers for a car dealer that I spoke to, who was standing right next to this vehicle as it sped by, says he knew the driver, didn't know him very well, but he had seen him many times before. And he said the one thing that he knew about him is that he had a hard time walking. And but we don't know whether, something happened to his legs or, that whether they got caught or something. He was speculating that that might be the case, but he didn't know that he had a hard time, difficulty moving around.
Well, such are the times that we live in that I've got to ask you, Fred, is there any indication that this might have been an act of terrorism or not?
Of course, that's the first question, right? And no, there's absolutely no indication that this was an act of terrorism.
And so what are officials saying about the people who were injured?
Well, we know that it's one man, 2 women who died. As far as the number of people who were injured, there are 8 people with serious injuries who were taken to area hospitals, and then 2 more with life-threatening injuries. Of the people with serious injuries, some have head, some have back, some have leg and torso injuries.
Well, that's WBUR's Fred Tice reporting to us about the terrible crash and accident that happened today at the Linway Auto Auction in Billerica. Fred, thank you so much.
Thanks, Meghna.
Well, let's turn to sports now and 2 things that happened last night that really highlight both the great and the awful aspects of Boston sports history. Now, in the greatness category, the Celtics' Isaiah Thomas poured in a glorious 53 points last night in Boston's 129-119 overtime victory against the Wizards in Game 2 of the Eastern Conference semifinals. Thomas said he did it for his sister, who died last month, because yesterday would have been her 23rd birthday. Now, on the other end, the awful end of the spectrum, last night Red Sox fans gave a standing ovation to the Orioles' Adam Jones. But this was after some fans hurled racist taunts at Jones during Monday night's game at Fenway Park. But as Commonwealth Magazine notes, standing up for Jones may make Sox fans feel better about themselves, but it doesn't do much at all to heal the deep old wound that is Boston and its sports team's history with racism. So joining us now with more is Shira Springer, WBOR sports and society reporter. Good to see you again, Shira.
Hello.
Also with us is Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN and author of Shutout, a story of race and baseball in Boston. Howard, it's good to have you back again.
Just like yesterday.
I know. Some stories will need constant care and attention here in Boston, let's be honest. Now, Shira, first of all, I just want to, you were at the Red Sox game last night, so we'll start with the Sox and end with the Celtics here. what was it like last night when that standing ovation happened?
Well, it was very moving, and I think, you know, the nice thing that happened was that Red Sox pitcher Chris Sale sort of stepped off the mound and let Adam Jones really relish the moment and let it sort of the cheers build a bit. I think at first there might have been a little bit of hesitation, like, and then you could hear the cheers building and people getting onto their feet. It wasn't a total standing ovation, but it came somewhat close.
Yeah. Well, we actually have some tape here of that moment. And this, again, is Adam Jones, or the sound of what happened when Adam Jones made his first appearance at the plate last night.
Adam Jones.
Shira and Howard, it's interesting because when you hear that, I mean, maybe it was different as people were watching. I mean, the cheering isn't instantaneous. And did I hear some booing in there, too?
It did. I think it's depended on where you were in the arena and who you were standing next to and who was surrounding you, cheering around me. But I think that, yeah, there were probably some people who are like, wait a second, we're cheering an opposing player. I mean, even though Mookie Betts, an outfielder for, you know, the Red Sox, said, hey, stand up for Adam Jones, you know, stand up against racism, I think people were a little reluctant. At least some fans I talked to were a little reluctant about cheering an opposing player.
Okay, I'm going to come back to that in a second. Mm-hmm. But Howard, is it meaningful at all that there was this response to Jones last night?
Well, sure, it's meaningful because the response, because people were watching what the response was going to be, and it's one of those situations where you might not be able to make it better, but you could certainly make it worse, depending on how they reacted. And I think that what's actually more significant is that the Red Sox are contemplating, which I don't think they should, I think they should enact it, which is a lifetime ban for anybody who is caught making racist remarks at the ballpark. I think that it's an extreme response. But it's as we discussed yesterday, this franchise has a problem, and sometimes you have to be a little extreme to deal with specific problems. This is something that is affecting, I don't know if it's affecting their bottom line, but it certainly is something that has affected the team's legacy. It has been mm-hmm. part of their legacy. So I think that more important than the moment when Adam Jones stepped into the batter's box, that the Red Sox seem to recognize after all these years that maybe it's time to actually really do something.
Yeah. Shira, let me ask you a little bit more about what you were saying earlier about fan reaction and some fans still feeling a little conflicted about cheering or supporting Jones simply because he's playing for the Orioles?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, a typical Boston reaction
in some
way.
Yeah, but isn't that necessary?
You want them to be bigger than all of that, right?
It lays bare the underlying problem, right?
Well, I think, you know, they, all the fans that I spoke to, and this was not a scientific survey by any stretch, but, you know, just casually talking to them, listen, they thought that the gesture was a nice way to apologize to Adam Jones. But they also were like, it kind of made them a little uncomfortable because, don't forget, Red Sox fans are among the most diehard and sort of stalwart of sports fans, and it's their team or no team, and it just sort of made them a little bit uncomfortable to see a partial standing ovation for somebody on the other team.
Well, I wonder what
Something else going on there, too. I mean, let's also not forget what else is going on. It's one of my favorite clichés, Shira, as you well know. But these two teams don't like each other for paying attention to what has been going on the past week with the slide going on with Manny Machado sliding into
going back all the way to last April April 21st.
Exactly.
Yeah, but here's what I wonder. I mean, there can be team rivalries and deep distaste for anyone who's not in a Red Sox uniform, but like that kind of tribalism just masks or excuses, I would say, a lot of fans' unwillingness to recognize that there's a problem here. I mean, as Shear was trying to get to before I cut you off, like, wouldn't you rather have fans stand up and say, yeah, Jones may play for the Orioles, but it doesn't matter because the bigger point right now is that Boston has to get past its racist
past. We'd like to think that some issues are bigger than sports and that fans can recognize it, but maybe you haven't spent enough time around Boston sports fans. And I don't mean to paint them, you know, in a bad way or anything, because I do think, you know, the people that I spoke to, like I said, were genuinely you thought it was a good gesture and liked this form of, if you call it an apology. But it is very, very hard for that Boston fan to see anything outside of their fandom.
I'll be perfectly honest. I have a problem with that kind of tribalism, though. I really do.
But let's remember something else, too. One, it's not universally agreed upon that Boston even has a problem. That's why this has been going on for so long. I think you've got different segments of the fan base, and you've got different people deciding how they were going to react. And I think that, yeah, Megan, you're right. Is this tribalism unacceptable? Sure it is. But in that arena of battle, you know how we've created in the sports world it's like a war between these two teams, and it's really silly. It's just a game, but people buy into this thing. It's my team against your team, and they get all amped up, and it really is something that is not easy for fans to do. Obviously, this is something that if you don't care about it, if you're not a sports fan, that you say, "Come on, really, guys? You can't."
Listen, I'm a sports fan, Howard, and I say, come on, guys. You know, one at bat, one moment. You can't just let him have that. And you know, also, though, you don't want it to be just one moment, one at bat. You want it to be something that has long-range, you know, repercussions. And, you know, Meghna, you mentioned about the possibility of a lifetime ban. Mm. And what I like to see coming out of this is Adam Jones is really wants to be on the forefront of stiffer penalties against fans. And his agent came out earlier today and spoke about that. Not only are they advocating, this is something we talked about previously, but not only are they advocating for that lifetime ban, but monetary fines. These fines, I know, Howard, you were saying they may seem extreme, but I'm right there with you. They need to be extreme to have a deterrent effect at this point, because I don't think a year ban does anything.
Right.
No, I don't think a year ban does anything anyway, especially when you look at the prices at the ballpark. How many people go to multiple games anyway?
Exactly.
And so there's that, but there's also something else there too, which is that the subject matter that we're discussing, we're talking about race in America, which is one of the more difficult things for anyone to agree upon in the first place, and certainly one of the most difficult things for anyone to take responsibility for. So I think that the hard part with all of this when it comes to demanding something from the fans or even expecting anything from the fans is that most fans are there to be entertained.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you ask them to take any sort of social stand, we see this a lot when it comes to the military flyovers and the militarization of a lot of sporting events these days, post-9/11, post-Boston Marathon, that in that case, yes, they don't view that necessarily as going out of their way, because it's easy to think, at least, that you're on the right side of that issue. But something like racism, whether you're dealing with it in soccer in Europe or whether you're dealing with race in Boston here, you're going to get a lot of resistance just from the standpoint from people saying, hey, it's not me, so it's not my problem.
Yeah,
and there's a whole other atmosphere that sort of happens in the ballpark. I mean, you saw that in the first inning itself when, you know, you have this one moment of, you know, mostly unity, where fans were on their feet and cheering Adam Jones. And then moments later, you have Chris Sale throwing at Machado a 98-mile-per-hour fastball behind him, you know, at knee high. And, you know, Machado was incensed afterwards. I mean, this was, you know, he had this expletive-laden rant. I mean, that may even be putting it mildly. I think he had
43 F-bombs, right?
Exactly. And so you have this happening, you know, within, like, what, 5-10 minutes of, you know, not the rant, but the actions on the part of the pitcher. And so you begin to see the atmosphere that's within the ballpark, that heightened atmosphere, all the emotion, and it's just a different world in some way.
Yeah,
exactly.
Let's not forget, you got the hyped up emotion, you got these two teams fighting for first place, you've got the fact that they're battling and throwing the ball at each other anyway, because Mookie Betts got hit the night before this whole thing happened with Adam Jones. And then on top of that, let's not forget the level of alcohol. Luckily, we're in the first inning, but as things get more and more and more intense, people do turn into the sports, and they have this sort of gladiator thing where it's like they feel like they're part of the battle too, and it's not just sort of entertainment, and it really can get out of hand unless you pay close attention.
But this question of alcohol is a really interesting one, because doesn't that again get to the point where, you know, if the truth comes out when you get sauced up enough, what does that truth say about Boston?
Exactly right. And the reason why one of the things that bothered me most about this was sort of the other fan reaction, which was, well, you know, the media is out to get us, the country's out to get us. We saw this with Tom Brady and Spygate and Deflategate, and now this is another example of, you know, us against the world. And what that does is that completely obscures what's really happening, that you've got a real societal issue here, and that the people in the city have had to deal with it. And if you're from the city, you've had to deal with it even longer. And you don't want that to be conflated with some ridiculous, you know, my team versus your team thing. The issue is much more important.
And you don't want alcohol to become an excuse for that behavior.
Absolutely.
I mean, listen,
exactly.
We know that there were 30. Serum. Yeah, exactly. We know that there were 34 ejections. 20 of those were alcohol related. But that should not obscure the fact that this happened or excuse it in any way. And I think the really interesting thing will be, you know, what happens in the next week or 2 weeks or a month from now. I mean, I hope the Red Sox are serious about, one, the investigation, but two, about a stricter policy. Let's see if that comes to fruition.
Yeah. I was going to say, sure, there's one other thing that we didn't talk about yesterday and didn't get there today, which is another reason why the Red Sox want to be out in front of this, and that is you're in a competitive marketplace. And do you really want to go back to the days where black players were going to have it written into their contract that they don't want to go to Boston?
Yeah.
The money has gotten past that, because if you're going to pay David Price $217 million, okay, he'll go play on the moon for that. But do you want to open that up again, where you've got people saying, you know what, I don't want to play for your team because of all of this stuff?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you want black players to feel welcome in Boston. And I can't help remember, sort of shifting a little bit to the Celtics, I think it was this past offseason, right, that Jay Crowder was upset that the Celtics were courting a white player, Gordon Hayward. So, you know, you have these dynamics at play where you want black players to feel welcome here, and they don't always feel that.
Yeah. Well, since you did mention the Celtics, and I promised listeners at the top that we would talk about the bad and the great of Boston sports that we saw last night, just to remind folks, Isaiah Thomas, 53 points. And how many of those were in the fourth quarter?
Fourth quarter and overtime, 29.
Amazing, right?
Crazy.
And his sister just passing away last month.
It was his sister's birthday. I mean, on top of that, you know, he's had dental surgery. I mean, that was not the most amazing part, but I'm thinking to myself, the guy spent, I think, 4 hours on Monday in the dentist chair with oral surgery, and then he had to go back to the hospital.
Yeah. You know, Sherrod, let me just jump in here, because we do have a little bit of tape of Thomas talking after the game about the fact that he did this for his sister. Here he is.
It's my sister. It's her birthday today. Happy birthday. She would have been 23 today. So everything I do is for her, and she's watching over me. So that's all her.
I could hear that all day long. I mean, incredible. I mean, tell me more about Thomas, because, first of all, you know, Sean Bowden, our producer here, keeps telling me, you got to talk about the fact that he's only 5'9", but he's pouring in all these points.
Hey, I come from a family of short people. So, you know what we say? It's not the size of the dog in the fight. It's the size of the fight in the dog. That's a Mark Twain-ism. You know, and I think that's part of the appeal, though, right, Howard? I mean, in the sense that you've got this 5'9 guy taking on players who are are a foot or more taller than him and beating them and dominating the play and setting the tone. And then you have this tremendous backstory. Like, I'm a believer that players and teams bond, like players become the face of their franchise, not necessarily because they are the best player, but because you have these moments, whether it's, you know, these whether it's in the playoffs or in the regular season, where you see something about their character come through.
That's right.
And then this is what you're seeing here happen now in this 2 week or so stretch with Isaiah Thomas. You're seeing a very special guy who played every game of the first round series after his sister's death, went home to her funeral,
yeah.
then came back. I mean, it was like a 36-hour turnaround to play in game one against the Wizards in the second round. So people are not just seeing what he does on the floor, but he is really showing something about his character and the way that he's handled all of that. And I think that the people of Boston have really fallen in love not only with his play, but who he is. And this is a guy, I think, if you're the Celtics, you want to keep on this team long term, pay the big bucks, not just because of what he does on the court, but because of what he represents.
Howard, your thoughts?
Yeah, no question. And I feel like, depending on how old you are, you remember when the Boston Celtics were imperious. You remember when the Boston Celtics didn't even advertise because in the 1980s, the Garden was sold out for the entire decade during the Larry Bird years. And you remember when everybody feared the Celtics except maybe the Lakers, and that
maybe.
They were on top of everything. Maybe. Exactly. And so the new Celtics are the Celtics that are in a competitive environment where they still have never gotten a black free agent in his prime to choose to play for Boston. Usually the great players here have to get traded, like Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen. And now you've got this player who's not even 6 foot tall, who has the name of one of your greatest enemies.
Yeah, exactly.
which is just incredible. And the beauty of the Thomas story is it's a big man's game, so we say, and that there's no way that a 5'9 guy is going to be able to dominate and be able to take you to a championship, because it really hasn't happened. Even the great Isaiah Thomas, who's probably the greatest, shortest player of all time, really couldn't get there until Steph Curry's 6'3".
Okay.
And
relative.
So relative, exactly. And so when you start to look at what he's doing, he's not just carrying the team as he did last night and as he's done all season, but he's also representing an identity, which is the new Celtic identity, which is not an imperious team, but really a team of kind of underdogs.
Yeah,
They're an ensemble cast. And ensemble casts really do not win NBA championships. You need a LeBron James or a Kobe or a Bird or a Kevin Garnett and a Paul Pierce. You need those super, superstars. And what he's doing is he's creating an element, a dynamic that we haven't really seen in Boston in a long time, if ever.
And it's fun to watch, man.
It's really fun to watch.
Well, Howard Bryant is senior writer for ESPN and NPR correspondent. Howard, thank you so much for joining us again today. It was great to have you back.
My pleasure.
And Shira Springer, WBUR Sports and Society reporter. It's so great to have you always, Shira. And I'm glad we got to end on this happy note about greatness in Boston sports.
Yes.
So thank you.
Thanks.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Rhode Island Senator and Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse is with us, and there are several important things to talk about with him. One, he's got an impassioned new book out about the corrosive influence of corporate money on American politics. The book is called Captured: The Corporate Infiltration of American Democracy. And Senator Whitehouse is on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and today the committee heard more testimony from FBI Director James Comey on Russian meddling in the presidential election. Comey told the committee that Russia represents, quote, the greatest threat of any nation on earth, given their intention and capability. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna. Terrific of you to have me.
So I promise you we will talk about the book. But I just wanted to start off with what you heard from James Comey today. Just your reaction to the testimony he gave the Judiciary Committee.
Well, a great deal of it was trying to fend off inquiries into ongoing investigations. I've been Rhode Island's attorney general, and I was the U.S. attorney for the state as well. So I appreciate what he had to do with those questions. He also did his best to try to convince everybody that in the disparity between the very public way in which he treated the Hillary Clinton email investigation versus the very confidential way in which he treated the Trump campaign Russia influence investigation. He was trying to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was not as convincing on that point.
Well, so let's just listen to a little bit of tape here. This is FBI Director James Comey again today speaking before the Senate Judiciary Committee, defending his decision to notify Congress that he had reopened the FBI probe into Hillary Clinton's emails less than 2 weeks before the election.
It makes me mildly nauseous to think that we might have had some impact on the election. But honestly, it wouldn't change the decision. Everybody who disagrees with me has to come back to October 28th with me and stare at this and tell me what you would do. Would you speak or would you conceal? And I could be wrong, but we honestly made a decision between those two choices that even in hindsight, and this has been one of the world's most painful experiences, I would make the same decision.
Senator Whitehouse, you said you didn't find Director Comey terribly convincing on this matter. Was he questioned about why he chose not to speak about the fact that the FBI had an ongoing investigation into the Trump campaign?
Yes. And in the same way, he said that it's the ordinary rule that people don't talk about ongoing criminal investigations. I think his original sin was back when they decided not to file any charges against Secretary Clinton. He should have just ended the press conference there. Instead, he went on a lengthy added discussion about her email behavior. That is what we call derogatory investigative information. If you don't charge somebody, you do not release derogatory investigative information. I think he made a terrible mistake going on after announcing the decision not to charge her with anything. And once he'd released that extra information, now Congress had something to ask him about. So it was hard for him to say no. So now he ends up dragged up in front of Congress. And then at the end of that, he answers a question, will you let us know if anything changes? So now he's stuck with that answer. And then they get into Anthony Weiner's laptop and he feels obliged to volunteer investigative information because of what he said to Congress, which he would never have had to have said if he'd simply followed the rules in the first place.
Right.
So I think this is a big exercise in trying to make himself feel better about a Bill Bruckner-type error that he made at the get-go.
Yeah. Well, I want to play one more piece of tape here, again, from the Judiciary Committee meeting today. And this is, in fact, you questioning Comey. And in a way, it links the FBI and James Comey and the Russia investigations to the broader issue of money and politics that you write about in your new book. So this happened today. This is you, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, asking Comey about shell corporations and their potential effect on American democracy.
Is it true that shell corporations are often used as a device for criminal money laundering?
Yes.
Is it true that shell corporations are also often used as a device for the concealment of criminally garnered funds?
Yes.
And to avoid legitimate taxation?
Yes.
What do you think the hazards are for the United States with respect to election interference of continuing to maintain a system in which shell corporations that you never know who's really behind them are commonplace?
I suppose one risk is that it makes it easier for illicit money to make its way into a political environment.
And that's not a good thing.
I don't think it is.
Yeah, me neither.
Senator Whitehouse, why did you want to ask James Comey about that?
Because I support legislation to require corporations, when they are formed in the states, to disclose who their true, what's called beneficial owner is. We've had a lot of problems with foreign criminals coming to the United States to hide money in shell corporations. The European Union is cleaning up its act right now in that area, and that means that there'll be more pressure from international criminals to come to the United States to hide money behind shell corporations. Of course, once you have a shell corporation set up, you don't necessarily just have to hide money in it. You can use it to hide your hand in seeking political influence. And because of the role of dark money, and because the Supreme Court misguidedly said anybody could spend unlimited money, that opens an absolute avenue for foreign political interference in our elections.
Right. So you're referring to the Citizens United case from 2010.
Yep, I sure am. Yeah.
So let's talk about that bigger issue about money in American politics, because that's what you write about front and center in your book, Captured, the Corporate Infiltration of American Democracy. And it's interesting because in the book, you basically put forward this idea that you don't actually think government itself is broken, but rather, you know, if we're seeing the slow degradation of the ideal of American democracy, it's because of the corrosive influence of money, right?
Yeah, I think we've got to learn as citizens to distinguish between the host and the virus. And the reason that the host is misbehaving is because it's infected by a virus, and the virus is enormous floods of often hidden corporate money, and right behind them, the threats that that capability empowers. You don't have to spend the money if you can. You can just threaten somebody.
Right. Now, you write about how, again, Citizens United was ruled on by the Supreme Court in 2010, and that in the years prior to that, there was, regarding climate change specifically, there was a really different feel in the Senate than after 2010. What was it like before Citizens United?
Before Citizens United, I sat on the Environment and Public Works Committee, and we were constantly holding hearings and debating climate change. There was a constant flow of Republican-sponsored bills to find various ways to limit carbon emissions. John McCain ran for president carrying the Republican banner with a really strong climate platform, and it was what you'd expect. It's a big issue. Did we get it right away? Of course not. But there was work being done. There were hearings being done. There were compromises being worked out. There was progress going forward. January 2010 comes Citizens United. The fossil fuel industry asked for that result, expected that result, and immediately put the new artillery that Citizens United gave them to work. And from that day forward, there has not been a single piece of Republican co-sponsored legislation to restrict carbon dioxide emissions. Stopped as dead as a flat line on an EKG.
And the effect was that immediate. I mean, you in the book you write about how you see concerted efforts, organized efforts to, in a sort of stepwise system, to deny the science that exists, question motives, and then exaggerate the costs of solutions here. How have you seen that play out in Washington?
Well, it gives a lot of talking points for people who come and lobby. It provides a way to fool the American public. And the fossil fuel industry goes to really extraordinary lengths to create front groups and screens so that their own hand isn't seen in this work. And it creates an environment in which there is less of a public feeling of urgency to get anything done. And then when you combine that with the unlimited political spending and the capability to threaten unlimited political spending on the election side, now a Republican senator is getting it from both sides. Mm. They have a public that is not demanding much of them, and they have an industry that's saying, hey, cross us on this and you're finished.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, though, because, yes, Citizens United did open the floodgates for unlimited amounts of corporate money to enter the political system. But we were headed this direction for quite some time anyway. I mean, we were looking back at numbers of in terms of campaign donations from the financial sector to both Democrats and Republicans. And ironically, before 2010, the financial sector gave in effect more money to Democrats than it did to Republicans. So, I mean, it was what I'm wondering is, we could have seen this coming, right? Because money has been playing a role in politics for a long time.
The role of money in politics has been is as old as politics. So that's always been the case. In those days, you usually saw the money show up in the form of a $10,000 PAC check or a CEO hosting a $100,000 fundraiser for somebody. And all of that would be reported and on the record. And every advertisement that you saw said I'm Sheldon Whitehouse and I approve this message, or I'm Elizabeth Warren and I approve this message, or, you know, whoever the sponsor of the ad was and I approve this message. Now you have unlimited amounts of money, which allows these threats to take place. You have phony organizations putting the ads up. I make fun of, you know, imaginary groups with names like Rhode Islanders for Puppies and Prosperity that are suddenly running huge numbers of ads on the TV, slamming somebody, and everybody watching that ad knows that that is not a real group and that this is weird. And then there's the dark money where you don't actually know who's behind it. And those things are all new and they are all different. And they all empower a very, very small section of the population, which is big industries who have such a big stake in Washington that it's worth their while to spend that kind of money. And the regular folks or businesses for whom that is not the situation get rolled and get ignored as a result.
Yeah. I'm wondering, though, sometimes I try to take the long view of history here, and I can't help but to wonder if, in a way, where we are now was inevitable because, I don't know, at least for 30, 40 years, maybe even more than that, we've been hearing constantly about the primacy of the free market, the infallibility of American businesses, the idea that all solutions, it's sacrosanct. American business is sacrosanct. And so
what's good for GM is good for America.
Right. That's kind of been an animating force in terms of how we even view the country. So for that to filter into politics seems almost inevitable. And it just sort of came to a head in 2010 in Citizens United.
Well, the really big difference is that for people who believe that corporations kind of have a better sense of where to guide America than regular Americans do, that's fine. And if they were standing up and saying, we are ExxonMobil, and this is our point of view, and we approve this ad, that would be one thing. What's sneaky and really challenging after Citizens United has allowed all this money to pour in is the ways that they found to pour it in, including through front groups, so that the citizen watching the advertisement doesn't actually know that it's ExxonMobil or the Koch brothers or whomever it is behind the advertisement. And then, of course, if you have the ability to threaten to spend to spend that kind of money, you necessarily have the ability to make the threat to spend that kind of money. And as somebody who spent a lot of time in prosecution work, you allow that kind of power, you are going to create corruption, because that is always going to be a quiet side deal with somebody telling somebody else in some dark corner, don't you cross us on this. We can put $5 million against you in the next election. You won't know where it came from. You'll never see it coming. We need you to get right on this, and we need you to get right on this right now. And that is a conversation that is, I think, empowered by Citizens United and deeply corrupting of our politics.
It makes me wonder if someone ought to bring a suit against Citizens United or file some kind of legislation saying that, you know, if the mere threat of millions of dollars pouring into a reelection effort can produce a chilling effect on how a politician operates or what he or she says, is that not an infringement of that politician's First Amendment rights? I mean, is it too far to say that? Because it's a First Amendment question that brought Citizens United to the Supreme Court to begin with.
Yeah, well, the theory is that money is speech and that therefore unlimited amounts of money have to pour into politics because you can't regulate money any more than you can regulate speech.
I mean, but what you're saying is
that the problem with that is that you can actually regulate speech in this context. If you're, you know, committing fraud, you can be prosecuted. If you're libeling somebody, you can be sued. If you're yelling fire in a crowded theater, that's not legal either. So it's a terrible argument that the First Amendment controls and dictates that unlimited spending by big, powerful industrial interests is mandated by the Constitution.
It's hard to think about hard to feel optimistic, Senator, to be perfectly honest, because, I mean, is the genie just out of the bottle here? Can we get it back in?
I think we can get it back in. First of all, the public hates the Citizens United decision. Republicans hate it. Democrats hate it. The public hates it. It's only good for a small group of very big dollar influencers who have the ability to take advantage of it.
But they have so outsized influence, as we've been talking about.
Yeah, and it's been expanded by this in kind of a weird circularity. So they've been able to shut down things like disclosure requirements, so you can actually see who's behind the ad, which we still could do in Congress. But ultimately, I think the Supreme Court is going to learn that they made a terrible mistake and they'll have to correct it themselves, and that Citizens United will go into the ash bin of history along with the Lochner decision and the Plessy decision and some of the other colossal train wrecks.
Senator, let me just jump in here because you mentioned the Supreme Court again, and I have to play a piece of tape from the nomination or the confirmation hearings for now Justice Neil Gorsuch, because you asked him why, again, these are during his confirmation hearings, why a group of millionaires and billionaires spent millions of dollars to stop Merrick Garland's nomination and spent millions of dollars in support of now Justice Gorsuch. Here's that moment.
The dark money group that is spending money on your election spent at least $7 million against him getting a hearing and a confirmation here, and indeed produced that result by spending that money. And then now we have $10 million going the other way. That's a $17 million delta. And for the life of me, I'm trying to figure out what they see in you that makes that $17 million delta worth their spending. Do you have any answer to that?
You'd have to ask them.
I can't, because I don't know who they are. Mm-hmm. It's just a front group.
An amazing moment, Senator, to be perfectly honest.
It kind of illustrated the point, didn't it?
Yeah.
The fact, just one other thing
sure.
on this, the fact that this is sloshed over from elected politics for the president and elected politics for Congress to trying to influence confirmation hearings and control appointments to the Supreme Court, that's another pretty grim step.
Absolutely. And we haven't even talked about the effect that it has on state and local politics as well. But we have just under a minute to go. And I do want to ask you, because I'm always grasping for solutions here. I mean, if I understand correctly, what you mentioned earlier, that Congress could, if it wanted, it could legislate a bill that would require disclosure of political contributions by corporations and others. Is there any possibility that could happen with this Congress?
Hard in this Congress, but because it's hard to find the pressure point to drive the bill forward. But if the House switches hands so that a Democratic speaker can say, okay, let's push this piece of legislation, then things can really start to move. And I think in a couple of years, the American public is going to be so sick of this that the bill will have to move one way or the other.
Well, Sheldon Whitehouse is the Democratic senator from Rhode Island. His book is Captured, The Corporate Infiltration of American Democracy. Senator Whitehouse, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna. I appreciate being on.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is the song No One Else from Dave Malloy's electropop musical Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812. And yes, Natasha and Pierre are the same Natasha and Pierre from Tolstoy's War and Peace. Dave Malloy based his electropop musical on a 70-page sliver of the Russian writer's masterful tome. But if a Tolstoy Broadway theater mashup makes even the lowest brow rise in askance, consider this. The musical just racked up 12 Tony nominations, more than any other show this year. Now, we spoke to Dave Malloy back in 2015 when the show was on stage at an ART production at the Loeb Drama Center in Cambridge. And Dave told us why he finds unusual adaptations so attractive.
Oh, the moon Yeah, it's strange. You know, when I read War and Peace, actually before I was a proper musical theater composer, I was more of just a kind of freelance musician in those days, and I was working on a cruise ship, playing piano in the cruise ship band. But when I read this particular sliver of War and Peace, it's about a 70-page section, about halfway through the book, I was just completely swept away by it and struck by how it had, like, the perfect structure of a Broadway musical. Like, it just kind of had that structure inherently in it.
So help walk me through mm-hmm. this, though. What about it was the perfect structure? Because I have to say I'm not quite familiar with what would turn it so quickly into a musical.
Sure. I mean, there was just the intense narrative drive of it. Like, yeah. You see this young woman, like, you know, just fall so quickly from, like, she's like the most glorious, you know, perfect, wonderful person in Russia at the time. And she's engaged to the perfect man, and he's off fighting the war. And then she just falls so quickly. And it's just like watching her go through this emotional roller coaster is just stunning and heartbreaking. And then in parallel, there's this second story, kind of like the B story, you know, in musical theater terms. And this B story, interestingly, is not another love story, but instead it's a story of this man, Pierre, and his kind of existential midlife crisis.
So you're reading War and Peace while at sea on, mm-hmm. on a cruise ship.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just a delightful image in my head. And you play one of the parts in the production.
I did. In the original production. Yeah. So and then I was on the cruise ship and feeling very kind of socially awkward. I just didn't really fit in socially on the cruise ship. So I really identified with the character of Pierre, who is this character going through this kind of existential midlife crisis and who is just a very socially awkward kind of sad clown sort of figure.
Well, there is a song in the show where you as Pierre, describe that state of existence. Mm-hmm. So let's listen.
I drink too much. Right now, my friend fights and bleeds, and I sit at home and read hours at a time, hours at my screen.
So Dave Malloy, a couple things going on there. First mm-hmm. of all, it's just the sound of that song. Not exactly the sound that one would associate with a traditional treatment of Tolstoy.
That song in particular was kind of inspired by Arcade Fire. I was listening to a lot of them at the time of writing that song. And yeah, again, one of the things I was so struck by in reading the novel was like how much like angst these characters have. And a lot of that angst just reminded me of the lyrics of a lot of like contemporary indie rock.
The wind is blowing all the ashes around.
So a lot of Pierre's music kind of has this kind of Arcade Fire, sort of epic indie rock feel behind it.
Yeah. And also in there I heard the reference to a screen, which I don't imagine at all. Well, I know it
totally.
Wasn't in the original.
It was not in the original. Yeah. So the song has, and the production rather, has a lot of anachronistic touches. So it very much is a bunch of 21st century performers putting on this show. It's also the experience that I have when I read those kind of novels. Like when I read War and Peace, I am reading it as a 21st century reader. So I'm always, you know, I'm not reading it the same way someone contemporary with Tolstoy read it. Like I'm like, oh, this is a strange turn of phrase here. Oh, what a curious custom this is, you know. So I like highlighting those things in the show.
Also, in fact, I mean, the music and the modern feel of the music really serves a purpose in the show too, because it's an electro-pop musical. Mm-hmm. It's been described as that. And in fact, like the real electric feel of the music starts when Anatole enters the story.
Yeah. And so the way the show is structured, the first seven songs are all acoustic. So the first seven songs, it's just, you know, the orchestra, which is cellos, viola, oboe, clarinet. And then Anatole enters in the middle of the seventh song. And when he enters, it's the first time that we hear these kind of techno songs. So there's a big bass drop when that happens and the subwoofers kick in.
An exceptionally handsome man walked in with a confident yet courteous air.
Because literally what he's doing is he's electrifying Natasha. Like, he's kind of awakening her sexuality. And so, yeah, it was this kind of wonderful dramaturgical coincidence I found as I was writing the pieces, because I didn't think of that immediately. But as I was writing, I was like, oh, all the electronic music seems to be happening when Anatole's around. And I was like, oh! Yeah, so it was a nice way to kind of justify that dramaturgically. Yeah.
And in fact, in the ART's production, everyone who comes will be literally sort of immersed in the the experience of the show. Like, the entire theater is being transformed, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the show kind of we turned the theater into essentially a Russian supper club or a Russian nightclub. So there's vodka being served throughout. There's tables. There's banquettes, and the action kind of happens all around you. There's no really stage per se. There's kind of a stage that is, you know, yeah, that the audience is completely immersed around.
Dave Malloy is the writer and composer of the electropop musical Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812. We spoke to him back in 2015 when the musical was on stage at the ART, and the show just got nominated for a whopping 12 Tony Awards. Awesome job, guys. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Speed through immeasurable space seems suddenly.